This podcast is brought to you by the Legarten Institute. I'm Sian Hansen, Executive Director, and we hope you enjoy this conversation.
I'm Shankar Singham, Director of Economic Policy and Prosperity Studies at the Legarten Institute. I'm here with Peter Boeke, who is one of the leading economists, particularly Austrian school economists, from George Mason University. And Peter, first of all, welcome to the Legarten Institute.
Well, thank you for having me.
We heard a wonderful discussion this morning, and I wanted to tease out from that discussion three themes and get your perspective on them. The first is what's going on in the US now with the election process and the primary process, particularly on the Republican side, but also the rise of Bernie Sanders on the Democrat side. This rise in nationalist, populist, protectionist kind of rhetoric that seems to be resonating with voters, not just in the US, but we see what's happening in Poland and Hungary and in Europe. There seems to be something happening in the world, some response to an underlying cause. Could you talk a little bit about your
perspective? Well, you know, I mean, you've identified something that's a very big concern for anyone who believes in cosmopolitan or liberal order. I was in Vienna in December and at the Institute for Advanced Study there, and the sense was just one of despair about this idea of closing all the borders and the sort of mobility of people, especially between in Central Europe, between Hungary and Austria, or when I was just gonna, you know, shut down. And there's also this kind of fear-mongering in the United States and disgruntlement. So let me just step back. There may in fact be very legitimate reasons for disgruntlement, which are now finding a voice among the young and others that are expressed in these populist candidates, such as Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump even. And so what we should be doing is stepping back and looking at the sources of that disgruntlement.
And one of the sources, I think, of that is inequality around, or perceived inequality around the world. Yeah. And what's the underlying cause of inequality? I think we've seen a lot of economic distortion that hasn't really been addressed. Right. Trade has been addressed. Property rights to some extent have been addressed. But domestic competition inside borders in many, many countries that have joined the sort of global system in the last 20 years or so, that level of distortion has not been addressed.
Right.
And that's creating some of these inequalities, and some of these inequalities coming from cronyism and so on.
Right.
So obviously inequality is a huge topic now. Piketty's book, lots of people talking about inequality. What's your perspective on that issue?
Sure. So I think that this is, you know, one of the fundamental issues of our age, obviously. And I think that we should step back and look at two different things. One of them is whether or not what does trade and innovation and opening up of markets actually do for inequality? And if you look at that, those are one of the great levelers of economic opportunity for people. And, you know, one of the things I'd like to have people point out, this is an Angus Deaton point, is that, you know, this past year is the first time in human history that we have seen less than 10% of the world's population is now living in extreme poverty. This is just phenomenal transformation in the last 25 years, as India, China, and other places have opened up to market and forces. It's just one of the great stories that we're not talking about. But that's about the creating of opportunities. But inside of countries, you have a lot of political actions which, in fact, shut down opportunities. And that's where you see these distortions. There you see a lot of sort of privilege seeking. And those who get the privileges end up by not allowing others to get on the bottom rung of the economic ladder, these what you refer to as economic distortions. And if you can't get on the bottom rung of the economic ladder, you can't climb up. I mentioned during the breakfast the book by Luigi Zangalis, A People's Capitalism, but I also like to mention in this regard a book by an economist named Casey Mulligan. Again, it's a very US-centric book, but it's called The Redistribution Recession. Mm-hmm. And what Mulligan identifies in that is over the last 25 years, how we've adopted public policies that have made hiring someone more difficult and made it easier for people who don't have a job to not have the job. And you combine that, you end up by seeing this difficulty of the sluggishness in the labor market. And what instead what you should see is a very vibrant, fluid labor market, but yet restrictions in the labor market don't allow us to do that. And I think so we see restrictions in labor markets, we see restrictions in commercial markets, you know, all of this stuff ends up by creating a kind of stagnant system which privileges some at the expense of others, and it's the others who are now, you know, voicing their frustration in the voting booth. And as I said in the breakfast, you know, Donald Trump is an entertainer, and his most famous act and the show The Apprentice, which everyone watched, was when he would point to someone and he would go like this. He'd say, "You're fired." And in some sense, this is what he's doing to the establishment claim. And I think it's a very bad development in our country that this is the level of public discourse, but it is what it is. And, you know, we just have to look at the ultimate cause of it and hope that the institutions are strong enough to survive any of these things rather than the personalities. But Bernie Sanders is the opposite of that for the youth. So, you know, you have one set of disaffected people, you have another set of disaffected people, both of whom are frustrated with the restrictions that they face and the possibilities that they see for their lives. And this is the kind of voice that you're seeing.
That's a very interesting insight. Part of this is also related to perceptions of the future and perceptions of where the global economy is going. And I think in that respect, you know, we've had a lot of work. Robert Gordon at Northwestern has talked about stagnation because of innovation, lack of innovation. We're, not because we can't, but because we've, in his view, you know, the big innovations have already occurred in the 19th century. Yeah. You seem to have the belief that that's not the case, that there is actually great potential for humanity. And that's backed up by our own work at Legatum on the impact of distortions and the fact that you could actually see huge economic growth, and this is not the new normal. So what's your response to the stagnation?
Well, I mean, you know, ultimately, I think that the ultimate resource is the human imagination. So I'm with Julian Simon in that regard. And so tomorrow will be better than today if you, you know, sort of unleash it. And I think I like to think about things. So what Gordon is capturing is an intuition that we all have. My grandparents were born into this world with a horse and buggy, and they departed the world with a man being able to go to the moon and fly transatlantic flights in, you know, mm-hmm. 6 hours. Mm-hmm. How can we see that same amount of growth? Wasn't that amazing just to see the horse and buggy to, you know, transatlantic flights? And it's hard for us to imagine that we're going to see that come. But if you just think about just the innovations that we have been through just over the last 20 years, it's amazing, right? Think about the evolution of cell phones. You know, I always, with my students, I try to communicate to them about the TV show Dallas. Mm-hmm. In TV show Dallas, the character that Victoria Principal plays dies. She is Bobby Ewing's wife. And she dies in the show because she's talking on her cell phone. And her cell phone is the size of her body, okay, at that time. And only someone like the Ewings could have a cell phone. That's in 1980s, okay? Now you go to any classroom anywhere, you know, whether kids have smartphones and they're able to, you know, check the professor's facts on Wikipedia, you know. You're wrong because, see, Wikipedia says this. And so that's just an amazing, you know, amazing technological innovations. And we don't even know what's going to happen with nanotechnologies and kind of disease curing with, like, you know, micro, you know, technologies or whatever. So I think that the human imagination is the ultimate resource, and the human imagination is unlimited. And so what the real problem is restrictions that we see, that these distortions that you're talking about that are caused by putting too many permissions on our innovative, you know, behavior. And so what we want is permissionless innovation, you know, allow people to actually see where they think there's a problem in the world and then offer the solution. And if it catches on, it catches on. If it's not, then, you know, they end up by being weeded out of the process. And we should see a lot more fluidity in innovations as well. And so the fact that we see restrictions, you know, that means that we're preventing people from coming up with viable solutions.
Just to end, to conclude, it should be possible then to look at sectors of society that are less burdened by these restrictions and so forth, and predict where big innovation can occur. Because you can look back and you can say, okay, the sector you talked about, telecoms, was a relatively unregulated sector.
Right.
Whereas in aviation, which is heavily distorted, not only through regulation, but through subsidies and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Well, it's no surprise then that we're flying the same planes that we fly, you know, that we flew 40 years ago.
Right.
So just as we end, make a prediction about a sector that might be an interesting one to watch, because where there's less distortion, the human imagination is freer to come up with these innovations.
I might not have a perfect answer for you, but I'll stick to the industry that I know best, education.
Mm-hmm.
So the innovations that are made possible now because of technology, the amount of information that's available to students, and the opportunity that they have to study in a weird sense with the best professors in the world, I think is going to put continuing pressure on the master teachers to actually become more responsive teachers to their students, because there's easier exit strategies, not at the elite places. You know, you're not going to get rid of Harvard, you're not going to get rid of Williams, you know, you're not going to get rid of Oxford, you're not going to get rid of LSE or Cambridge, but you might get rid of some of the middle level schools. Right. Will feel more of a pressure for them to actually respond, because the students can watch a lecture by the very best professors, you know, in these places. And you're going to see it's going to be globalized. And so you're going to have, you know, kids from the poorest regions of the world that get access to technology, actually studying, learning, you know, what people at MIT are saying. And they're going to, so I think that we don't have any idea what the world will look like in higher education, but we have a good bet that it's not going to look like the way it is today.
Yeah.
There will be some continuity, because remember, it's existed since 1200 to today, with the idea that you need a mentor to help coach you, because the internet is full of a ton of information, but very little knowledge.
Right.
And learning how to sort that is from maybe a tutor or something. But for a lot of classes, you'll have this mixed university, online classes, in-class classes. And so I imagine that's going to have all kinds of change with the way we think about tenure, the way we think about what counts as promotion and whatnot, publications. So I just think I personally think it's fantastic to embrace it.
Yeah.
And look at the dynamics of change, rather than sit there and look and say, well, it's not quite like it used to be in the 1950s. Isn't that terrible? I think it's going to be this amazing thing, but it's going to be uncomfortable to people like me who've grown up in the traditional system, but it should be amazing for the kids coming up behind it.
Great. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us at the Gotham.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
To hear more podcasts from the Legatum Institute, please visit our iTunes channel or website at www.li.com.